excavating. Digging deeper. With Erin. Every Wednesday. You don't need a shovel. You just need to listen. Excavating with Erin.
It is Wednesday. It is Excavating with Erin Ward. How are you today?
Happy Wednesday.
Yay. I love it. Every Wednesday, we look into your blog. I've come to the conclusion why I like your blog so much. And first of all, it's the description of your writing that I like and the way you express yourself, but it's more than that. It's the topics that you write about. I get the feeling that these are things that people go through, but don't necessarily talk about in day-to-day conversation, but they're important things that affect lives.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I hope this, I mean, my writing and also our conversations are just like spaces for people to have permission to feel what they feel and know that they're not alone and that it's human and that we don't have to do things perfectly. We'll all have experiences that cause pain and also those that cause for celebration. And I hope that we get to look at both.
No doubt. And I just started the Yoga Muzi Podcast Facebook group page. So, if you're listening, search for that. And I really, you know, think that that page is going to be something that plays into our feature on the show, this blogcast, Excavating with Erin, where people may have follow-up questions or feedback or even topics to explore for you to write about. And then, of course, you can always hop on, do a Facebook Live, and you and I can do it. Like, there's so many, it just opens up so many doors where our community can now not just be spread out over the world and not connected with each other, but now they can connect with each other and take the show to where it never ends.
Oh, I love that so much. Yeah, I would love for people to share what they're interested in exploring or having people talk about.
Yeah, and it also makes you feel like you're not alone if you're having that type of day. You
know what I mean? Yeah, for sure.
So the title of this week's blog is called The Hungry Ghost. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read the first paragraph that you wrote.
Yeah, sure.
I want to share a part of me that in hindsight paints itself with clarity. And only now, years removed, am I able to send compassion and tenderness to the young woman in my memory, a girl and her dance with the hungry ghost. So my first question, what is the hungry ghost?
So the hungry ghost is my reflection, my memory of this this experience I had when I was in college, and I was experiencing turmoil with my relationship with my body and with food. I was using it as a way to cope with a sense of spiraling or out of controlness, not having control over what was going to happen in my life. And so the hungry ghost, I like ghost because it now when I reflect back on it, it is a memory. So it has that past quality.
Sure. But
it also at the time was this kind of like lingering thing that was going on inside of me that no one really knew what was happening except when they would see me and kind of the progression of what was happening to my body. So it was like this kind of secret world that only I knew and that I communicated with all the time, but no one really knew until I would let them in on it.
I've never heard that expression before. I'm sincerely asking you, did you make that up?
Yeah. It just spoke to me as what the situation felt like.
It makes so much sense. And really hearing you speak about it now, that it is a ghost, because a ghost is something we can't see, apparently. I mean, sometimes people see ghosts, whatever. But overall, let's just in this case say that a ghost is something we can't see. So for you, you had this ghost, which you communicate with. But really it had to do with your hunger or lack of hunger or your control of your appetite. So from the outside looking in, until the physical got to a point where it was no longer, you know, able to be hidden, then your ghost really was no longer a ghost. It was your life. It was a living, breathing thing.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And I don't say fascinating like that's great. No, it's just interesting to refer to it like that. Very, very deep and poignant. So you go on to write about the hungry ghost. When you were in your 20s, you stopped eating. And you had witnessed peers in high school experimenting with different methods to find thinness. But it wasn't until college that you turned towards deprivation to try to quote unquote fit in. So you stopped eating because I didn't feel like I was doing enough quote unquote to be worthy of love. So my question is on the surface, I totally get that statement, but isn't it ironic that because you felt unworthy of love, you were stripping yourself of something that nourishes us and gives us life?
Totally. It's one of the biggest ironies, I think, of any sort of addiction or behavior that doesn't actually serve us.
Yes.
It's never about the actual thing. You know, gambling isn't about the actual whatever slot machine or card, or it's never about the thing. It's about the feeling that the thing represents or can stand in for.
Yeah. And
for me, it was this belief, this limiting belief that if I didn't achieve a certain standard, or if I didn't meet a certain standard, then I would fail. And if I failed, then I wasn't worthy or deserving of outside love. And I wasn't at that point, not that it's a problem, because it's a lifelong journey of, you know, meeting yourself. But I think at such a important time in my growing up experience, I didn't have the awareness to stop and check in and ask really what was going on, because it was never actually about what I was eating or whether I was eating. It was just something that made me feel better that I had control over.
Right. And I'm going to continue reading on a piece of your blog, which would be the way to proceed on past what you just mentioned. So these are your words. I felt overwhelmed by my finances, the pressure of a rigorous academic course load, surviving in a new and powerful city, and my uncertainty of what I wanted in my life. At the time, I did not have the wisdom to pause and check in with myself. The scared little girl, underneath all the noise, I did not have the clarity around why I was feeling as if I were caught in a spiral, spinning and winding further out of my own control. What I knew was that I had complete control over what I ate, or in my case, did not eat. I turned to making myself small and compact to prove that I could count on myself. My mission was to shrink, and by doing so, prove that I had self-discipline, that even as my life seemed to be living me, so I ate one portion that I was in complete control over. So many times we look at the behavior, but not the reason behind it. Many times it has to do about control, taking control of anything we can. In a way, for you, it wasn't about the food. It was about power and finding some ground that you could stand on that you built. I often wonder why this feeling of a need to control manifests in destructive behaviors. Like if I wanted to take some control of my life, why can't I vow to read one book a week or meditate at least once a day or any other things that nourish and give life instead of destroy and take away life? And I don't say that in judgment. I say that as someone who has been through addiction, has been through, you know, a struggle with food and being overweight. So I get it. But why do we, if it's about taking control when we're out of control, why does it seem to always manifest in destructive behaviors?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it comes back to the belief that's behind all of it. You know, it's not like someone is like, you know, I want to gain control. And let me back up. If you're feeling out of control and like you don't have agency over a situation. Mm. That tends to spur a place of that tends to spur fear. That tends to spur a not enoughness. It doesn't tend to spur like a, oh, that's okay, cool. Let me feel good about this. I think it's much easier for us as human beings to look towards what's wrong and what's wrong with us rather than like then look at a situation as possibility for growth. I don't think that's the immediate thing we look towards.
Yeah.
And I think it's the extremism that happens with things like addiction and because food is something we need and it's so accessible to us. Luckily in the West, it's accessible to us for the most part. It becomes a thing that is very easy to manipulate, to try and resolve or try and counter whatever that limited belief we're feeling is. You know, I'm not enough. I don't feel safe. I don't feel grounded. I need more. There's a lacking, or it's too much. And I think if there was an awareness to pause and be like, oh, I'm feeling this way. Let me be kind first and then choose things that I know would be actually really supportive on my path rather than this like something's wrong with me. I need to do something to be different and change. Then it would be a different conversation.
Maybe. And I agree with everything you just said. And maybe one of the reasons that we go into these destructive patterns, whether it be food, addiction, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, whatever, fill in the blank, right? That the world that we feel is out of control is filled with a lot of things that are hopefully productive. Like, okay, for you, it was school. It was, building friendships, working with your rigorous course load, growing your life because you moved to this big city. So you have a lot of things expanding in your life, but with that comes pressure and this feeling of being overwhelmed. So there's a guilt that comes with that feeling or a sense of defeat. So like you said, like when we come from feeling fear or a place of defeat or overwhelm, yeah, of course, we're going to look into darker ways to remedy that, perhaps. And I don't know if that's 100% for sure, but I think it makes sense based on what you said and what I feel based on what you said.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate statement. I think that there's something called the negativity bias, where our minds go to, you know, it's like if 10 people told us that they loved the class you and I led on Friday and one person said that it stunk, then you would remember the one person, right? And I
absolutely
think that happens in our daily lives in smaller and larger ways. You kind of get fixated, or it's much easier to get fixated on a negative and then to use that negative as reason why you're not enough, or as fodder for this negative belief. Like for me, it wasn't that this belief started when my disordered relationship with food started. It was something that had been there lingering, and this kind of acting out, this behavior, this deprivation was what pointed my awareness to it. It was like, oh, this is it manifesting. This is it playing out in my world. This belief that stems, you know, way back.
Can I ask you, if you don't mind, and you don't have to answer this?
Yeah, I think what you said is completely accurate.
Thank you. Can I ask you a follow up question? Being that you know that it was there, Erin, mm-hmm. I'm here.
Oh.
Can you hear me?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it cut out for a second.
Okay. Am I good now? Because I want to ask you a question.
Yeah. Yeah. Did I get cut off? Did you hear
me? No, you were good. I got you.
Oh, okay. Great.
I just have a follow-up. So the awareness that this feeling inside goes back further than when it manifested with controlling what you ate or didn't eat, right? Do you think, looking back now, that it manifested in other ways, even as a kid? Like, I don't, however far back it went, just any mm-hmm. other little ways that it manifested?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, nothing is ever all good or all bad, right? Everything is we live in this world of gray, and that's outside of binary.
Yeah.
And for me, when I was little, performance, we talked about this a little bit the first time you had me on,
which yes.
was so wonderful. But I came to believe that I needed to perform in order to receive attention.
Yes.
And it was no one's fault. I don't blame anyone. It was kind of my own spiritual curriculum, call it, to learn the hard way that you don't have to be perfect. And it's still a lesson that I'm learning. But growing up, I mean, I remember being so upset in first, second grade when I would get red marks on my homework. And I was just like, this yeah. is not okay. I need to do better. I'm going to do better. And that propelled me to work very hard and consistently and fall in love with school and also in sports. Mm. And it made me want to have a lot of friends and build relationships because I wanted to, that became really important to me and kind of with my heart and also with that part of me that wanted to perform and wanted to be validated. So I do think it's definitely integrated into my life, which I think is kind of a positive because it means that this isn't like a huge mountain that showed up and it's this big problem. It's like, oh no, this is this experience and my relationship with food now is a work in progress, and it's part of me, and it doesn't have to be stigmatized, and I don't have to feel bad that I went through it or no one has to feel like they're less than because they're going through some sort of difficult time with themselves. But rather it's your journey in growing. It's your journey in coming into a deeper awareness of who you are and why you choose things that you choose. And then my ultimate hope is that we step into a place of empowerment where we recognize yeah. that we have choice every day of how we speak to ourselves and how often we're willing to forgive ourselves when we slip or when we do something that we know is part of an old pattern. You know, it's okay.
You know, it's amazing to me because we have the most brilliant computer in between our ears. Okay. Mm-hmm. The most brilliant computer is our freaking brain, because without our brain, we couldn't have created the best computer that exists. So clearly the superior, most superior one is in between our ears. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we are sometimes the shittiest programmers. So maybe we just need to take courses in programming and learn how to, just like we would learn how to code or, you know, people in IT that are brilliant at it, take control of this computer operating system and get it to function and run the programs that make us feel good rather than running the programs that have viruses in them or make us feel bad. It's our, I mean, we are the programmers of it. Let me pause and say, I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying, how about we just start to become more aware of that and actively pursue that?
Yeah. Yeah, we are. And to believe, it's so interesting because I think we also have to work not only with, okay, I want to reprogram, but also work with the belief system that's present that led us to the programming that we have. And I think for many of us, it stems from this misbelief that we need to do something in order to have love or be loved or give love. Like we have to, the more we do, you know, or the more we get closer to X, then the more we'll be happy, the more we'll be loved. And I think to work with the sometimes uncomfortable truth that we actually don't have to do anything. And no matter what size, age, shape your body is, or how refined your mind is, or how many, you know, things you've written, or whatever, it doesn't matter. You're always in the presence of love if you choose to be. And it doesn't quite make sense to our intellectual mind that is rooted and is so associated with a progress narrative. The more I do, the happier I'll be. You know, it's very, it's kind of how we learn from a very young age at school. Like, you'll be rewarded when you do well, and you will be punished when you do not.
It's very Pavlov, the way that we're brought up in the school system. At least it used to be. I don't know anymore.
Yeah. Well, and it's helped us achieve a lot. Like, it's helped us. We're so technologically advanced. We're creating amazing things. Medicine has skyrocketed. We're living longer. But it's also interesting to consider, like, not on paper, how we're actually doing. And that's really interesting to me as a teacher of practices that try and bring us back to ourselves. There's a lot of things telling us that back to ourselves isn't a good place to be.
I want to ask you this question. And it goes, again, you said going back, we have to look for the roots and the stems of where all this began, right? So if you look back in your own life, and I could do it too, and I already know my answer for this. If we come from a theory that as adults, what we are seeking to strive for is the main thing that we lacked as a child. And it could be the attention from a particular parent. It could be the praise. There's so many things that it could be. And then as adults, we seek to attain those things that we're lacking way back before we had control of our life as children.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, for me, I'll open up because I just heard this concept about a month ago, and I was like, gosh. And the person said, you can figure out someone's main motivation based on what they were missing out on or lacking or deprived of as a child. And I was thinking about myself, and I said, you know, geez, I'm the youngest of four boys, and I was like kind of the added child, and not really, I didn't feel like I counted all that much. Like, I wasn't abused or anything, thank God. And I'm not, you know, not even going to go there. If anyone is or was, I'm sorry, you know, it's horrible. So don't think I'm saying that. But what I'm saying is that I think that I never felt that I was validated and that I counted like the way my brothers did, or a certain brother or brothers, you know, I had three of them. And I wanted to be heard, and anything I said wasn't really taken with merit. It was like, you know, there he goes again, you know, screwing up. Even if I did good, it was just like, you know, I'm just the young one that's just, you know, fucking up, you know? And I think I already know, because I watched the thread of my life, it's all about being heard. It's all about having a voice. And it manifested through radio, it manifested through teaching, you know, regular school and then yoga. It's always about, for me, it's about expressing myself and being heard. And it goes back to not feeling like I was heard or understood. I wasn't understood either.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a huge thing. Like, being seen, being understood, being heard. They're all qualities that we all want to experience.
Yeah. And for me, it goes way back to my childhood. And I think that because the age gap in my parents, I would tell my mom some things, and how don't you understand what I'm saying? Like, don't you? And she'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. And she grew up in poodle skirts, you know? And I'm talking like to her about, like, you know, gangster rap in Nirvana. I'm 16, you know, like when she's 16, it was like lollipop, lollipop. Mm-hmm. So there's a big disconnect there. And I'm trying to express all these ways about how I feel and what I'm going through. And I'm looking to really reach and try. And I just feel like there's no way I was being understood other than, you know, because of a generation I grew up in was so different. I wasn't necessarily doing anything bad, but it was so shocking to them.
Yeah.
You know, and I just felt misunderstood, and it was a horrible feeling. And I think that's what drove me to do basically everything that I've done in my adult life.
Right. Yeah. How interesting is that? Do you feel, can I ask you a question?
Of course. This is a two-way street. It's a tension.
Yeah.
Hit a ground stroke back, for God's sakes.
Do you feel like you've been able to forgive both your parents and the environment you grew up in, and also yourself for those feelings and for maybe acting out on those feelings?
So that's a great question. And I'm going to answer it because I've certainly explored it over the years. So I'm going to, it's a two-part answer. In my 20s was when I really felt I needed to go out and prove myself. And that's when I got into radio and all of a sudden I was on the air on Long Island where I grew up. And my friends from high school heard me, my brother, my parent, you know, my mom, and everyone heard me, and like I had become something, a voice to be heard and that they could be proud of, right? So that made me feel good. Now hold on to that word good, because I'm going to come back to it. So I said, okay, well, if I do this, then everyone's happy. And then that makes me feel good. So I ended up deciding to leave radio and go back to school. And that was my own choice, just based on the industry and moving around. And I just wanted to take control of my life and make it a little more stable, because moving from city to city, just it wasn't right for me anymore. Mm-hmm. So when I went back to school and I was just going to be a school teacher, you know, and it was like more internal satisfaction. There wasn't a, like, you know, from the outside looking in, well, hey, you can't get me concert tickets anymore. Hey, I don't hear you on the air. I can't tell my friends that you're on this station. Like, even my mom, you know, like, I mean, I know she listens. She probably feels terrible right now. I'm not trying to make her feel terrible, but it's like, I had to cope with that and figure out how to come to grips with it, that external happiness or the desire to be heard and please the people that didn't hear me and understand me. When I finally came to grips with that's a losing battle. There's nothing to be gained. Then I was able to finally heal and also forgive. Mm. And, you know, from all the way from being a teacher all the way up until now, I've first had to be okay with redefining my life and finding inner happiness, which of course yoga helped with, and that anything from the external is not going to be staying with me permanently and to give me happiness, and that I could develop who I am as a person and not just someone on the external that appears one way and is, in that case, you know, pleasing the people I wanted to please. And coming to grips with that first by myself, and then really not learning not to care, but also not just not care, you know, but to explain and help, for example, my mom, help her understand why I felt that way and how, you know, I've made the decisions I've made, and that I, you know, I do love her so much, and that I realize there's a huge gap in our generations, but whether she knew it or not, some of the things that we would talk about and how she would just look at me blank or not really understand would make me feel horrible. But it wasn't her intention. But I think I needed to explain that. And perhaps there is a sense of forgiveness that comes with that. And also with my, you know, with one or two of my brothers, particularly one, who always really put me under his thumb. And for no reason other than that, I got my mom's attention the most as the youngest. And he took that out on me. I didn't do anything to hurt him, but he treated me horribly because he said I was spoiled, this and that. But all I did was just be born the youngest child. I didn't act it out. I didn't do anything. I just existed. And he treated me horribly for that. So, I mean, that's a lot of baggage, a lot of things to work through. Mm-hmm. And I think finally, the true moment happened 3 years ago. Or no, not 3 years ago. I'm going to be married 2 years in April. When I had my wedding, okay? And my family came down. And I think that's when it's like, okay, he's like, let's just get over all this and like really love each other, because this whole thing is not that long, you know?
Mm, yeah, I love that.
So I released the anger part of it and the frustration part of it. And I tried to understand it maybe from the other side as well. And I think that helps.
Yeah, I think that's so powerful, the understanding it from the other side. That's so key, because it makes it no one's fault, right? And I think when you apply forgiveness to anything, it feels to me kind of like pouring sand. You know, when you're trying to put out a fire, let's say, like a campfire, even.
Sure.
Forgiveness to me feels like pouring sand on it, whereas blame and making it wrong, like the making wrongness of whatever's happening, like that's bad, that's wrong, feels to me like blowing into the fire. Like you're actually just making it bigger. So I feel like as much as we can apply both forgiveness and understanding and try and step into the perspective that we're all doing the best we can, right? Even if we make mistakes or even if things don't go as we plan, like we've never done this before, this thing called living. And yeah. Like we're doing the best we can. And I think that kind of softening into the perspective can be really helpful.
You know, I agree with you 100%. And it's funny because Billy Joel is from Long Island, and he's iconic on Long Island especially. And he has the song, The Angry Young Man. And I relate to that, who he was at that time, especially growing up in the same, he references a lot of places that I know, but I was the angry young man through my teens all the way up into, you know, my 20s. In fact, my success was based on anger to prove. You know, it's underneath all of it, there was a drive that was fueled by, you know, I'll show them, you know what I mean? And that's probably a way to propel yourself to do things, but it's certainly not the best way to go about it. It's almost like using steroids, you know, they can get you bigger muscles, but in the end, it's not the best way to do it, you know?
Yeah.
So I think when I finally released myself from being the angry young man and the adult who could come to grips and work through everything and find and seek peace more than the being angry, that's mm-hmm. when everything in life started to change. And again, I'm going to say that yoga helped immensely with that for me.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Because I did go to therapy, but I felt that it didn't help. Because if I don't know if you've gone to therapy or even you want to talk about, but I don't care. Mm-hmm. I will. And
yeah.
I went to therapy, and what I found was I had good therapists and bad therapists, but I found that, you know, what we focus on becomes bigger. And eventually you're talking about your problems and you're talking about the issues. But at least with the people I saw, we weren't really focusing a lot on solutions. It was like, here, just talk and talk and talk and talk. And I get it. You know, you get it off your chest, but at some point there has to be like, let's make a plan to be proactive and decide how to move on with your life and you know, strategize to make yourself feel better. Not just like, oh, like I swear to you, sometimes I would go to the therapist and I'd be like, I don't really have anything to talk about this week. And I would just be like, feel pressure to make something up to talk about.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I really love therapy. I think it's just the most amazing. But I also recognize that it's really interesting, or it's really important to also be in your body. And sometimes therapy can just kind of talk therapy without, you know, then taking a next step to put it in your body can kind of bring you around in circles in certain cases, especially when it has something to do with your body. In my experience, one of the reasons why yoga was so helpful, because it was a process where I was being kind and loving and opening my body and unwinding some of these beliefs without my mind even knowing I was doing it. You know, it was like my mind caught up to my body when all of a sudden my body was feeling strong and I was feeling empowered, and my mind was like, oh, maybe I am strong and empowered. So I think both things just hold each other's hand, but addressing the mind and body, especially for anyone going through something with food or their body, is so important to use the body as a way to heal.
Well, yeah. And I think look, therapy's good. Okay. It's been around for a while for a reason, right? Like it doesn't help people. In my case, I have the ultimate story, which is why I had to stop. So there's things that led up to this, and I'm going to keep it moving. And I'll share the full experience in the audiobook, because it's one of those things where it's such a crazy story. But at the time I was teaching public school, and I was being bullied really by the principal and the academic facilitator. It's because I didn't do things exactly the way they wanted me to do it. So I was being basically, you know, micromanaged and potentially blacklisted so they couldn't mess with my career. And so I got really mad, you know, and I was having trouble sleeping and everything was just bad. My cat was dying, and I had two cats. They were brothers, and the young woman had diabetes, was dying. Like, everything was bad. And my doctor gave me Ambien to go to sleep. So I couldn't sleep. Well, lo and behold, I started abusing it. Okay. So now, bad, 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 bad drug. If you use it and it's, you're awake, well, you know, you can actually take it and stay awake. And what it does is it's in the class of drugs called hypnotic. So we have a line in our brain which separates the hemispheres, what's reality and what's imagination. It takes that line and throws it out the door. So you're awake in a dream state if you stay up, which is super dangerous. You're not drunk. You're totally coherent. The next day you can't remember a word you said, but it was like this crazy, awesome conversation that you pulled out from who knows, your subconscious. But it got so bad, I won't go into some of the things that happened, but I would talk to my therapist about this. And I still see the same doctor, my general doctor, that I saw during that time and through the time that I was heavy. And I love her to death, because ultimately I told her, never prescribe this to me again, even if I beg you for it. And I tell her, like, she's the huge part of saving my life and to where I am today. I've been seeing her for 10, you know, I see her 10 years, my doctor, my primary. And she's like, no, that's you. You get credit for it too. I'm like, no. So what happened was the Ambien, the things that were going on with it were so bad that I would tell the stories to my counselor or my therapist. Mm-hmm. Well, the next time I saw her, she came in with a letter and asked me to sign it. She was breaking up with me. So she basically said, if you don't check into this place, I can't see you anymore. And I was so bummed out. I was like, no, are you fucking kidding me? Mm-hmm. And then I told her, no, I'm not signing that, you know, screw you. And then I left, and I was like, how pathetic is that? My counselor just broke up with me. She's like, I can't help you anymore unless you do this. And she, in hindsight, Erin, I know she was right, but it felt so terrible at the time. I was like, what a loser am I? My counselor broke up with me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's also wonderful though that she identified, like, I'm not the one who's going to be able to support you. I mean, it's so hard in the moment. It's like when someone breaks up with you and being like, I know that I'm just not good for you, or like, you're not good for me, or what, or I'm not good for you in this scenario. But it's still hard. It's still like hard not to take it personal.
She was saving my life. She didn't want my life on her conscience, you know?
And she cared about you, because like if she didn't do that and then she wasn't able to support you, then and she didn't care, she could be like, okay, I tried.
Long story short, I took the letter to my doctor, who I still see, just, you know, as a general checkup. You know what I mean? Like, she's my doctor. I've been with her forever. So, and at that time, I showed her a letter and I was like, look at this. This is crazy. And then I told her, I said, I'm going to be honest with you. This is not good for me. Never prescribe this to me again. I abused it. So to this day, I don't crave it, but it's on my chart. It's like, don't give this to me. Mm-hmm. Because I have that relationship with her where it's like, she wants my greater good. And I think that you need to be, if you want to get better, whether you have an addiction or you have something, you know, that is negative, you have to be honest with yourself and then honest with the people who can help you.
Yeah. And I think a big part of that is to be able to not feel like there's something wrong. I think we lie about things because we don't want to ripple the waters or make people like we'll be bad people if we admit it. But one of the main things I wanted to communicate with this blog and just putting it out there is that, people go through this a lot, like all of us, and it's not wrong. It's not wrong to have an experience that asks you to grow. And I'm really grateful, and it's something I still work with and find it popping up for me, especially when I feel uncomfortable or like a bit overwhelmed or stressed out. These patterns still reemerge, but I'm really grateful because it's given me such depth of awareness and also not just compassion, but empathy for people who are showing up and talking about these things. And the amount of times that I've gone deep with another woman and man about these sorts of things, and there's been this beautiful moment of like, wow, yeah, it's so crazy how we both had these thoughts and we thought we were like terrible people or like the only ones or had this like dark, dirty secret. Yeah. And it's actually, I think the more we can talk about it and the more we can say, hey, you know, yeah, mental health is like any other health, physical, emotional, like it's a practice and it's something that we put energy to, and talking about when we feel sick and when we don't feel great. It's not that there's something broken about us. It's just that we're going through something that needs care and tender attention.
Yeah. And the stigma of anyone that might have some mental illness or, you know, going through a depression, the stigma in our society, which I think has gotten better, but overall it still exists. It's terrible because, like, you know, it's not that someone chose that. It's the same thing. People can fight me in this or argue, but I believe it's the same thing as someone that genetically has a problem with their knee or, you know, a diabetes or something. You know, it exists and we should not put a stigma on it and not pretend that, oh, someone's just saying again that they're having a bad day. Look, they're just a complainer. Like that's the worst, you know? Mm-hmm. No, not true.
Yeah. So,
going back to your blog, which continues upon your last thought, which is kind of cool. So you write, what I realize now is that I was not alone. Even if at the time I felt that the insidious thoughts and the self-lacerating practices I employed were mine only, they were not. I've since spoken to hundreds of women personally and my friend Andrew and read the stories of thousands more, that wasn't in a blog, I'm sorry, who sing of their own struggle with the addiction to perfection, with whether it's overeating or not eating, disordered relationships with food stem from a source way deeper than the skin. And it's an epidemic plaguing women, particularly in the West. So I want to ask you, do you think at that time in your life, Erin, if you would have found women in school doing the same things, you would have been able to maybe overcome or at least improve upon the situation?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that was a big part of my healing process was, I entered into groups. I found groups of in my experience that were just women, that talked about these things and that were there and facilitated by a psychologist through,
yeah.
I went to NYU, and I mean, that still stands out in my memory as one of the most supportive things I've done. And at the time, I don't think I realized how supportive it actually was, but just that safe space to kind of come and not, and just like to, you know, let it speak it out and not feel like you have to hide anything or it has to be any different than it is, but just the compassion and like the, you know, the sisters in the group nodding their heads and being like, yeah, me too. And there's something so powerful about solidarity.
Yes.
In anything we do, about knowing that we're not alone. So yeah, I think that was huge. And then my peers, my friends, who still I consider some of the closest people in my life, their ability to also talk with me about it, even if they weren't experiencing the same degree, but you know, to be like, yeah, you know, I have these thoughts too, or this is how I work with it, or here's my experience. It's really powerful.
It is powerful, and it's great. One of the most beautiful feelings, not only to know that you're not alone, but it's cliche, but I still agree with it. The truth sets you free.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
You know? And if you don't set it free, it's going to eat you up. It's going to eat you like a parasite, you know? So there's nothing better than the truth setting it free. I love it. So you talk about the word desire coming from Latin roots, and it means to move away from the start. In my case, this is your words again, I have to preface that, the desire to feel a deep sense of love manifested in trying to create a circumstance in which I could feel worthy of it. So you're talking about something from the external. I want to ask you a question. So I don't want to be too religious, but rather spiritual. If we surrender ourselves to a higher power, do you believe that this feeling of not being worthy of love could lessen, not just for you, but just in a generality? Because with our surrender to a higher power, we know that all mortals are imperfect, and we can have our spiritual dialogue with whoever or whatever our higher power is asking for, with guidance, and knowing that our higher power will always love us no matter what, whether it's the universe or, you know, whatever label you want to put it. I'm not out to do that. I'm just asking the question of surrendering to something larger than us can maybe help us with being attached to the circumstances and situations of our external that we get connected, we get obsessed with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my grandma used to say, you know, whenever I'd be complaining, or I'd be like, oh, this is going wrong or whatever, she would say, you know, offer it up to something bigger than you. And it was her way of saying, you don't have to figure it out, and you don't even have to know what you're offering it up to. Like you said, you can call it whatever you want, but this kind of belief that there are so many things that we can't control. And even just that practice of offering something to something bigger than you releases that need to control it bit by bit. And
yes,
in my experience, and I think in a lot of different sorts of addiction or eating disorder experiences, sweeping generalization, but I do think it there's a big thing about control and trying to mitigate uncertainty or navigate uncertainty. So even just that practice of, you know what, I offer it up, is so powerful, because it's saying like, you know what, I don't need to be in control.
Yeah. And I just think it's important that, at least I feel from this platform of the show, and also when I was teaching yoga in a class, that I would try to preface that I'm not here to put a label on it, what that is for you, what that is for you. But I believe it can be helpful. So if you want to take me up on that, or yourself up on that, you know.
Right. I mean, because who knows? We're human. We don't actually know what the higher power is. We can speculate. We can call it something that feels good for us, but no one can ever be like, this is the higher power, you know? But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you call it, what you want to say it is. But yeah, that simple act of releasing control to something bigger.
I'm going to finish with this last piece of your blog, and I think this kind of sums it up nicely. It took me years of letting my hungry ghost control my life to finally pause, take a breath, and ask my heart to trust that it was not only worthy of love, but that it had been surrounded by it for a lifetime. It took me a roller coaster of disordered eating to see that ghosts are only scary if we believe them to be real. I satiate myself with honesty, forgiveness, supportive community, and self-love. And it was only then that the yearning ghost felt full and let me be. I love the line, ghosts are only scary if we believe them to be real. So how did you finally come to the empowering belief shift that your ghost wasn't real?
I think it was through, definitely not an overnight thing, but no. I think it's an understanding or a going inward and a process of being willing to look at what's happening.
And was there a particular point that stood out where you said, you are not real? You know what I'm saying? Like, you didn't have to yell it out, but a pinnacle of this experience that you remember.
You know what? There's not a particular point, because I think it is such, in my experience, such a process, like such an ongoing thing. Sure. And when I write about it in reflection, things become more clear. And that's one of the main ways I process information and experience. But yeah, I can't say there was kind of an aha moment. And I'm kind of happy about that, because I honor it as a process, you know, not really as something that was there and now it's not. It's like, oh no, this is something that I'm going to be working with for a bit.
I think I was just looking for the cinematic ending to the podcast.
Yeah.
Screw you, ghost. You're not real. Yeah. I don't see you anymore.
Bye.
Ghost. Mm-hmm. But you know what? We're not about fantasy. We're about being real, down to earth, and what's practical and useful. And I think what you said is the practical and useful answer, not trying to come up with a Hollywood ending of you killed the ghost.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. All right. Another great one in the books, Excavating with Erin. Thank you so much. I look forward to this every Wednesday. And I think that we're helping people. At least you're helping people. I might just be here hanging out, but you're helping people.
Oh my goodness. No, you're totally. I'm so grateful we get to do this every week. It's so much fun.
It is. If you're listening to this right now, I just want you to feel that you're not alone, and that if there's anything we said that you connected with that can help you with your day, then I'm grateful for that. And I don't want to speak for Erin, but I would imagine that Erin's grateful for that as well.
Definitely. And yeah, I hope people feel free to reach out. These things can be sensitive topics, but you know, it's kind of like the more we talk about them, the less of scary ghosts they become.
There she is, Erin Ward. Thank you so much, Erin, and Excavating with Erin. You could find the link to her page in our show notes, which is on every single platform that this thing appears, which is Stitcher, the iTunes podcast, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean. There's some weird one. Someone put us up on a podcast in Spain, even though it's in English. I forget the name of it, but we keep appearing in different places. But anyway, they can find you. I put the link to Erin because I really think that if you're going through some of this stuff, that Erin does coaching virtually. So it doesn't matter if you live in Los Angeles where she is. You can touch base with her. You should if you're feeling this connection.
I would be so honored. Thank you so much, Andrew.
You got it, my friend. Until we speak again.
Yay, until next week. Have a really wonderful rest of your week, everyone.
Hey, you. Yes, you. And you. And you over there. I see you. Stop hiding. Hi, how are you? It's Andrew. I want to invite you to a place where the show never ends. The Yoga Moves You Podcast Facebook group. It's a special Facebook group for the Yoga Moves You Podcast listeners where you can connect, give feedback, ideas for the show, ask questions, and spread love. Head over to Facebook and search for the Yoga Moves You Podcast. I look forward to seeing you there.